This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Kathy Manley about the case of John McKenzie.
McKenzie was given an indeterminate sentence. When he completed his first 25 years, he came up for parole and was turned down 10 times, although he had done everything he could to rehabilitate himself and express remorse. We learn about a broken parole system.
Attorney Bill Goodman from Detroit joins us for an update on the lawsuits in the Flint, Michigan water crisis.
He was the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the main forces behind the stop and frisk victory. Went back to Michigan, and he's doing some good work there.
The suppressed 28 pages from the investigation of the 9/11 attacks are finally released.
Now we know for sure that several members of the Saudi Arabian government were involved in supporting the terrorist attacks. But you heard it first on this show when we interviewed Senator Bob Graham from Florida, who predicted that this is what the released documents would show.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, last week we lost a friend of WBAI and a fighter for social justice, Lillian Pollack.
Lillian Pollack was 101 years old. She was the oldest volunteer at WBAI, and she was a fan of our program. She was a radical from the 1930s, lived the almost entire expanse of the 20th century, and we salute her memory, and we will link to articles about her on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
And Michael, she was a member of the Granny Peace Brigade, a wonderful activist organization who was with us in the Peace Pentagon and is now with us in our new offices on Canal Street. Michael, we recently marked the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing.
August 6, 1945, the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and then several days later a second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, killing some 200,000, incinerating some 200,000 people, and killing by slow radiation death many, many more. The common wisdom in this country was that dropping the bomb shortened the war and actually saved lives, both American and Japanese. That's not true. And scholarship has demonstrated that that's not true. So the question is, why was the bomb dropped? And the answer is, it was dropped to frighten the Russians. It was the first shot in the Cold War. And in fact, because developing the bomb and getting it ready took so much time, the war was actually prolonged. And I personally experienced that because my father was a Marine, went in 1942, he got out in 1945, and he was one of the Marines that fought across the Pacific towards Japan. The last battle that the Marines fought was on the large island of Okinawa. That's where my father was wounded. And that was going to be the staging point for an invasion of Japan. The Battle of Okinawa, in my opinion, was unnecessary, and that the Japanese could have been brought to the peace table even sooner. So my father had his leg blown up in a bomb. That was unnecessary. How many American soldiers died in Okinawa? Many, many. It was one of the most ferocious battles of the South Pacific. And all of this was to perfect the atomic bomb and to use it and to demonstrate to the world, and particularly to the Russians, that America would not shy from terrorizing a civilian population to get its way in the post-war world.
We still have the threat of nuclear war.
And how? With the buildup of American nuclear forces right on the border of Russia. We certainly have that. And we also have that with the commitment by the Obama administration to spend $1 trillion in the next few years to completely revamp America's nuclear force. And Hillary Clinton's foreign policy is to be extremely aggressive against Russia. And now you see all these neoliberals and neoconservatives, the whole ruling establishment, lining up behind Hillary Clinton and this new aggressive foreign policy. So I understand that Trump is a maniac and certainly wouldn't want to see him as president, but I don't have good feelings about Hillary Clinton and the people that are supporting her and the new nuclear policy against Russia either. Thursday morning, August 4th, 70-year-old John McKenzie was found dead in his prison cell at the Fishkill Correctional Facility in New York State. 9 days earlier, in a 2-1 decision, the parole board denied parole for McKenzie for the 10th time in the past 16 years since he became eligible. In 1975, when he was 29 years old, McKenzie was sentenced to 25 years to life for the shooting of a police officer during a burglary. He spent 41 years in prison. Each time McKenzie appeared before the parole board, it held that his crime showed a, quote, serious disrespect for the law, end quote. And it further stated that granting him parole would, quote, undermine respect for the law, end quote. In 2011, pursuant to a New York State executive law, the parole board was required to consider not just the nature of the crime, but also factors such as participation in rehabilitation programs, release plans, and the risk of recidivism. His attorney, Kathy Manley, sued and got a favorable decision from State Supreme Court Judge Maria Rosa vacating the 2014 denial of parole and ordering a new parole hearing. The new parole hearing ruled again that he should be denied based on the nature of the crime. So on May 16th of 2016, Judge Rosa again ordered a new hearing. This time she said that the parole board members who had ruled against McKenzie the two other times should not be allowed to sit on the parole board, and that a new hearing had to be held immediately, and that the parole board would be fined $500 a day for every day they didn't hold a hearing. I was optimistic, but he couldn't stand it anymore, said Attorney Manley when she learned of his death. We speak with Attorney Kathy Manley about her criminal law practice in Albany, New York, and we welcome her to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, how did you first get involved representing John McKenzie?
Well, about 4 years ago, his good friend Jim Murphy, who I had known doing prisoner support work since the 1980s, he called me and asked if I would help with a parole appeal for John. And I looked at the case and I said, oh my God, this is the poster boy for somebody who really should be released, who should have been released a long time ago on parole. So I got involved and I did two parole appeals for him. The first one was denied, and the second one, a new hearing was granted.
And tell us what it was like when you both first met.
Yeah, I went to visit him when he was in Woodburn, and he had been there for quite a while. You know, and he didn't need to tell me about his crime. I mean, that's all the parole board ever wants to know about. But he told me about it, and he started crying when he described how he had killed this man, Matthew Giglio, and how horrible he felt about that, and how horrible he felt for his children. And this was after I had agreed to represent him, and I could see how genuine that was, and that he lived with that remorse every single day, and yet the parole board says he's not remorseful. So I was just so impressed with him, and the more I got to know him, the more impressed I was.
What legal challenges did you face in representing him?
Well, really, the biggest problem is that the parole board has way too much discretion in that they can basically resentence people, because when a judge sentences somebody to a minimum term, the expectation you would think is that if you do well, then you should get out when you get to that minimum term. But the parole board says, no, if somebody's guilty of murder, we may just never feel like letting them out. And especially when the victim is a police officer, because apparently they think their lives are worth more than anyone else's. So really the legal challenge is that the parole board is allowed to just never let people out. Yeah, they're kind of violating the law, at least in the where we were was in the Appellate Division 2nd Department, where we were on the second appeal, the one that was granted. In that court says that you can't deny release based only on the circumstances of the offense, which in this case was in 1975, over 40 years ago. And the parole board was actually violating the law by doing that over and over, denying release based only on that, because there's nothing else in John's case that could justify them denying release.
Wait, I want to make clear. Are you saying that if a judge sentences someone to 10 years in prison, the parole board has the authority after the 10 years to keep them inside?
Well, it's when it's an indeterminate sentence. So in other words, it's a sentence that's 20 years to life, or it's when you have, it's basically usually for murder when this happens, although it happens in other cases too where they deny people, but then eventually they get to a point where they have to let them out. But when somebody's convicted of murder, the sentence is often like 20 years to life, 25 years to life, which is what John's was. And so since the maximum term is life, technically they can keep them in for life, but, you know, the expectation is the reason that there's that indeterminate sentence is if you do well, you should get out when you get to your minimum or at least soon after that.
They're essentially basing it on the facts that originally got that person sentenced. They don't consider mitigating or good behavior or changes or remorse as positive factors?
They don't seem to care about any of that. All they care about is the fact that somebody died, and in this case, the fact that it was a police officer who died, and therefore the person should never get out. That's the attitude of many, many commissioners on the parole board, and that's not the law, but that's what they've been getting away with for way too long.
Kathy, how did you prepare John McKenzie for appearing before the parole board?
You know, I didn't really, because he had been appearing before the parole board so many times already. He knew what he was doing. He had his parole packet, and you know, it was perfect. There was nothing else he could have done. He talked about how remorseful he was. He talked about how he set up a victims awareness program in Greenhaven and helped other prisoners to come to the same place of remorse that he had arrived at when he went through this transformation in 1983 when he met the head of a victims group. And it just hit him all of a sudden, like, oh, my God, no. I was thinking about myself, but I killed somebody, and I destroyed their life, I destroyed their family's life, and he got it back in 1983, and he, you know, sat with it every day since then. But I didn't really have to prepare him. He had all that prepared for the board, and he did excellently before the board. I saw the minutes. You know, he had a whole packet of letters of support, of statements that he wrote. And there was nothing I needed to do there. What I did was later with the appeals when he was denied.
Did he tell the board about the $10,000 that he raised to set up this program where the victims of the crime meet the people that committed the crime?
Right. He had that in his statement. He had a written statement, and then he would also speak to them. And so certain times that was brought up, and other times it wasn't. I mean, as far as the grant, he got that grant. And Greenhaven, I think, decided that this was just somehow they didn't like this. This was a threat to them, that a prisoner-initiated and run program was so successful, so they shut it down, despite the fact that it was actually rehabilitating people, which is supposed to be their goal.
Yeah, I have a friend in prison who set up an AIDS program, and they shut it down for the same reason you just articulated.
Kathy, what was the reaction of John's family?
Well, the reaction, I mean, all the times he got denied. I mean, he actually had lost contact with his daughters. He has two daughters, and their mother didn't let them see him or contact him at all for many, many years. And it was just within the last couple of years that they reached out to him, I think through a cousin that he was in touch with. And since then, he was able to reestablish close relationships with both of them, with Danielle and Denise. And Denise actually went and visited him. He spoke to Danielle on the phone. He has grandchildren he spoke to. He didn't even know before. So they're devastated because they just reestablished this relationship with him. And they, you know, they see he's going to the parole board and they think he should get out. And they don't understand why it's not happening. So they were devastated. And, of course, you know, when he just couldn't take it anymore and he took his life, of course, they were completely devastated. I'm glad that he was able to reestablish the relationships with them, but it's almost harder on them. I don't know. Anyway, it's horrible.
I understand that in 2011, a New York State executive law required the parole board to consider not just the nature of the crime, as you've said they did, but other factors such as participation in rehab programs, release plans, and also the risk of recidivism. What's been happening with that? Is the parole board not doing that? And are they in violation of that executive law?
Well, I would say they are, because the intent of it was clearly, just as you said, to not just look back in the past, but to look at, based on this risk assessment instrument they came up with, this compass instrument that tries to measure the risk that someone will do well when released. It's supposed to be forward-thinking, yet they completely ignore it. In many cases, they did it. In John's case, the compass was perfect across the board. Extremely low risk, like no risk. And they just ignore it. They just still go back and say, well, you know, your offense was so horrible that we're going to deny. That's it.
Can there be a legal challenge to all these parole boards in New York State because of that?
There's been some federal cases filed, but they haven't been very successful. What was showing maybe some sign of success was this idea of saying that, especially in the second department in New York, where the court actually said you can't deny release based only on the circumstances of the offense, and then they proceeded to do that anyway, that you could say that's in contempt of court. And this is what happened in John's case. The Judge Maria Rosa in Dutchess County Supreme Court ordered a new parole hearing, because that's pretty much all they can do when they find that the parole board has acted illegally. They order a new hearing, and then when that new hearing happened, that was last December, they denied him again solely based on the circumstances of the offense. And so this is an idea I got from another lawyer who had done it. I filed to hold the parole board in contempt, saying that you violated a clear court order. The judge told you you can't deny release based only on the offense, and you did. So you're in violation of that court order, and you're in contempt of court. And she granted it. She granted the contempt motion. Last May, we had a hearing, and John testified, and the parole board presented absolutely no evidence. And she made a point of saying that in her decision and held them in contempt and awarded sanctions of $500 a day.
And did they pay that?
They did not, because it was under appeal. It was They appealed, and it was stayed pending appeal to the second department. And I was actually pretty hopeful about that appeal, because there was nothing else they could have pointed to, because it was the second department itself that said, you can't deny release based only on the circumstances of the offense. And here it was really clear that's what they were doing. So how was that not contempt? So I was hopeful. I mean, who knows what they would have said, because, you know, the way I think might not be the way they think, but it looked good to me, and I was hopeful. And John just couldn't wait anymore. They had just denied him again at a regular board this past July, just recently, just before his death. So now that he died, the appeal is apparently moot, which
right.
means that Judge Rosa's contempt decision stands as a precedent for other people to use. So I hope other people, or maybe me with another client, that I hope there will be other contempt orders, and, you know, maybe they'll be upheld on appeal. But that's one avenue. The other thing is the legislature has to change the law, so that they can't do this.
I understand that on June 16, 2016, nearly 900 people had applied for parole, but only 258 were released. What efforts are there to reform what the New York Times calls a broken parole board, and as you yourself know from firsthand experience?
Yeah, there's a bill called the Safe Parole Act that's pending. I guess it might have to be reintroduced, but one of the things it would do is mandate that if someone is denied, the parole board has to tell them what they can do so that they can be released next time. So therefore, they can't tell them, obviously, you have to change the past. I mean, you know, so the idea there is that they have to be forward-looking and they have to give them a chance if they do the things. And in John's case, if that was the case, there was, I don't know what they could have possibly told him. I mean, so that's a good bill. I support that bill. I wish there was something that was even clearer. In some states, and even the feds, before they abolished parole, they had a presumption that the feds, it was a little different, but there's some states that have a presumption that if you get to a certain point, maybe your minimum term or maybe a little bit after that, and if you've done well, if you have a good record, and they certainly know how to measure that in various ways, you have a presumption of release, and they have to have some very strong evidence of something else other than the offense of conviction in order to defeat that presumption. So I think there needs to be language like that in the law so that they have to let people out when they get to, you know, if they have a good record and they get to a certain point.
We have one final question, and that is if you could talk briefly about the role of police unions.
That's a big part of this. Because the victim in John's case was a police officer, the Police Benevolent Association of Nassau County and other ones do this too, they went to the parole board every 2 years when John would come up, and they did a petition drive, and they said, never let this man out. We don't care how remorseful he is. We don't care what he's done since he's been locked up. He can never get out because he killed a police officer. And that's not the law. That's just what they believe, you know, and they are a big part of the problem. The parole board seems to listen to them quite a bit. They've had press conferences in his case. They're really... were determined that he die in prison, and he did. They got their way, and I'm just so angry at them and the parole board, and it was really the parole board that made the decisions, but should not be listening to them.
We've been speaking with criminal defense attorney Kathy Manley. Kathy, we're running short on our allotted time, but I wanted to read a quote from Denise, John McKenzie's daughter, who said after he took his own life, "The time for change is now. Let my father's fight not be in vain. If anything good comes from his life, an unnecessary sad death, let it be change." And I know that you've got a poem that John wrote, and I wonder whether you could share that with us.
Sure. Hopefully I can get through it without breaking down, because it's really heartbreaking. This was a poem that he sent out to some people as part of his last letter. And it's called Death's Trilogy. The first part is called Slow Death. Sentenced to life, condemned for an eternity to linger alone, abandoned in the lake of hopelessness, ostracized by pandering hypocrites and sycophants, waiting for a dysfunctional tribunal to meet again. Denied parole every 2 years, then return to the emasculated collection of forgotten souls. Alas, to lie dormant in suspended animation in the dungeon of obscurity until resurrected for the habitual evil pleasure of the immoral majority. The second part is called Reaper's Debt. Ever near my constant companion, there, looming in the dark of night, even in the light of day, roams the invisible shadow, negotiating eternal refuge after 40 years of torture, lost, abandoned, and forgotten. Eventually, hopelessness prevails. Now time's toll awaits its debt to the reaper. And then, the last part is called No Escape. Solid, cold, unyielding earth locks me away, never to breathe the warm winds of summer again. Confined beneath, closed in by concrete and steel, even in death, I am a prisoner. By John McKenzie. Sorry.
Well, Kathy Manley, it's just been a terrible thing for everybody involved. And we salute you for your resoluteness and your good representation. We wish you all the best, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really hope John's death is a wake-up call to change the system, like his daughter Denise said.
Thank you, Kathy. Take good care.
Okay, you too.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, high-ranking former members of his staff and others, are the target of a federal racketeering lawsuit over the city of Flint's water crisis. The lawsuit, which also names the city, alleges that officials tried to balance the city budget through a pattern of racketeering activity. It claims that they committed mail fraud by continuing to mail water bills to Flint residents, which they allege fraudulently misrepresents the city as providing safe, clean water to residents. A group of 15 citizens filed the lawsuit, seeking financial compensation for property damage, loss of business, and financial losses and damages for future medical care attributed to the water crisis. It also alleges that officials misrepresented the suitability of the Flint River water as the city's drinking water source for approximately 2 years and billed Flint residents at rates that were the highest in the nation for unusable water, yielding a $3.3 million surplus and resulting in the city's budget deficit being reversed. The lawsuit claims the defendants committed wire fraud by allowing residents to pay their water bills online or with credit cards, despite knowing the water was toxic. RICO lawsuits require attorneys to prove that wrongdoing was part of an ongoing enterprise. If successful, it allows for treble damages. Joining us today to talk about his class action lawsuit in the Flint water case and other criminal cases is attorney Bill Goodman. Bill is the former legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights and is a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Bill, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Last time you were on, we spoke about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. What's happening? We understand there's a federal racketeering lawsuit that was filed in April. What about criminal charges?
The Attorney General of the state of Michigan has filed several criminal charges against officials of the city of Flint, and I would say lower-level officials of the city of Flint, former officials of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, state of Michigan, and some former officials of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services for basically attempting to lie and cover up a situation that was going on with regard to the water and to keep the public and the citizens of Flint in the dark. Those criminal charges have now been filed, and these criminal cases are ongoing. Nobody on a particularly high level has been charged by that. I mean, certainly not the governor, anyone really close to him, or any of the heads of any of those departments that I mentioned. But there are some criminal charges that have been brought. The Attorney General of the state of Michigan is basically a political enemy of the governor, but I think he's anxious not to push this so hard that the governor has to resign, because then the lieutenant governor would become governor of the state of Michigan, and Schutte would have, the attorney general would have competition when he tries to run for governor in the next election. That's sort of the political status of things.
Now, you're involved in litigation yourself, Bill. We spoke to you about it some months ago. Can you give us an update on your litigation?
Well, we represent a class of citizens of Flint whose lives have been, to some extent or another, ruined or certainly badly damaged as a result of the crimes that have been committed by these various bandits who claim to be governors and state treasurers and so on. And we're suing under the Constitution of the United States, among other things, because this constitutes a violation of due process, of equal protection. There's clear racism involved. That's the essence of our claims, yes.
And that's a class action?
It purports to be a class action. We have to wait for the judge to basically certify a class at some point, but we're trying to bring it as a class action, yes. There are 100,000 or at least victims of this outrage.
Michael and I were talking earlier about the RICO lawsuit. That was brought by 15 citizens. What do you think the chances of prevailing on their theory are?
This is something brought under what's called the Civil RICO statute, which basically allows damages to be obtained when you can show that there has been basically a damaged property or property interests or contractual interests arising from a conspiracy to engage in what's broadly defined as racketeering, which is any kind of underhanded activity, basically. That's what the RICO statute is all about, and it's a thoughtful and creative approach to litigation. I think that in this case, there has not been a great deal of success, or in cases like this, there's not been a great deal of success in people who bring RICO cases. We thought about it, and we rejected the idea.
Well, usually people think of a RICO case as a criminal case brought against the Gambino crime family or the Hells Angels. And here it's a civil case. And I thought, I agree with you, I thought it was an imaginative theory because the lawsuit alleges that $3.1 million was made by these people selling what they knew to be poisoned water to the citizens of Flint and then billing them through the mail. So they got them for mail fraud and also wire fraud because they allowed them to use credit cards and paying for it over the computer. Mm-hmm. If this holds their feet to the fire some more, more power to them.
I agree. I'm with you and with them. I agree. It's a creative and thoughtful approach. But the cases are hard, very hard to prove, and I think that the constitutional claim which I've said, which is that public officials should not hurt the people whom they are responsible for, and they should not engage in racial discrimination. The politics of that are to me, more real. The legal theories are more real as well.
Right.
The government of Flint, the Democratic elected government, was removed, and it was that emergency manager that presided over all of this. So there's
several emergency managers. There were three of them who presided over it. Yep.
It strikes me as being not only undemocratic, but because these emergency managers were put into place in a number of predominantly African American cities in Michigan, it strikes me as being not only undemocratic but racist.
Yes. Actually, there's a separate lawsuit attempting to have the emergency manager law declared unconstitutional, which our law firm is also involved in, that was just argued in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. But that case had been thrown out of court on every theory except race discrimination. The race discrimination case, the judge said, could go forward.
Nice work, Bill.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Well, Bill, this was a great short update, and we hope to have you on again in a few months with more developments.
Good time.
I hope we can get some developments.
Right.
You be well, Bill Goodman, and thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Michael, there's been a lot of news recently about the so-called 28 pages. And before we talk about what's contained in those pages, we should remind listeners that this refers to an entire section in the official report of the Joint Inquiry into Intelligence Community Activities before and after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. This is not the 9/11 Commission report. It's an 838-page report that came out in December 2002, and the section at issue is now declassified. It's called Finding, Discussion, and Narrative Regarding Certain Sensitive National Security Matters. What's in those 28 pages?
Sensitive, and how? You know, Heidi, when we interviewed Florida U.S. Senator Bob Graham, he couldn't tell us directly what was in there, but what he said indirectly in our interview, and we're going to play this for our audience, what he said indirectly was this. He said that there were elements of the Saudi Arabian monarchy that were involved in financially supporting and giving help to several of the hijackers on 9/11. We have to ask ourselves, why was it that this report was suppressed for 14 years and then really downplayed when it came out? And I think the reasons are twofold. One is Saudi Arabia used to, not so much anymore, but used to be the main supplier of oil to the oil companies in the United States. And secondly, and now, and more importantly, I think, is that Saudi Arabia is one of the main purchasers of arms from American arms manufacturers. Just recently, they bought $40 billion worth of weapons, which, incidentally, they're using in Yemen to kill Yemeni civilians. So I think that the relationship with Saudi Arabia and the United States is a delicate one. Obama has nurtured that relationship. He just went over there last month, and I think the two things he talked to him about were arms sales and how they were going to handle the release of the 28 pages. So with that in mind, give a listen to our interview several months ago with Florida United States Senator Bob Graham.
Retired U.S. Senator Bob Graham from Florida is the former head of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He's also the leading person trying to get President Obama to release to the public the suppressed 28 pages of the 9/11 report, which until now have been hidden. Senator Graham contends that the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabians, could not have pulled off the operation alone, and that in fact they were part of a support network involving the Saudi Arabian monarchy and government, which helped plan, pay for, and execute the complicated 9/11 plot. Senator Graham said otherwise it would have been impossible for them to accomplish this. Senator Graham has written the book called Intelligence Matters, The CIA, FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. It provides a candid insight to the workings of the U.S. in Saudi relations and their implications on U.S. foreign policy making as it pertains to the Middle East. Senator Graham, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to start by just asking a bit about your background, where you grew up, what the influence of your father was, and what positions you hold in the U.S. Senate.
I grew up on a dairy farm about 25 miles northwest of Miami. I was very influenced by my surroundings, which were the Everglades, a passion of mine. I was very much influenced by my parents. My father was a very wise man. He was also a very high integrity person and had run and been elected to the Florida State Senate in order to be a factor in cleaning out some of the corruption which had afflicted South Florida during the post-World War or pre-World War II period. That was a significant influence on my subsequent decision to pursue a career in elective office, and I frequently used the examples and lessons that I had learned from my parents in various political decisions that I had to make.
Senator, you served on the 9/11 Commission when you were still in the Senate, and you've said in the past that you became disillusioned. And I wanted to ask you, why was that?
Well, I did not serve on the 9/11 Commission, which was a citizens' commission. I co-chaired, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the joint inquiry of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees into 9/11, with particular focus on the role of the U.S. intelligence agencies. After we finished our inquiry, which was in December of 2002, the Citizens Commission accepted our voluminous materials that we had developed and an over 800-page report, and they commenced their investigation, which went beyond the Intelligence Committee to a number of other agencies, such as the role of the Federal Aviation Authority.
Senator, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. Do you believe they could plan, pay for, and execute the complex plot of 9/11 involving hijacking of airplanes without external support?
Absolutely not. These 19 people, most of them did not speak English. Most of them had never been to the United States before. Most of them were not particularly well educated. That they could carry out a plot of this sophistication over a time period, which for some of them was 18 months, and avoid detection is implausible. That's the word that the chairs of the 9/11 Commission have used to describe this matter. It is impossible plausible to me that the United States government, 15 years later, still clings to the position that these 19 people did, in fact, operate alone without any external support, and therefore their inquiries have, in my opinion, been very unnecessarily truncated, because they haven't gone into the question of who were the groups that supported the 9/11 hijackers, because they don't believe they exist. The U.S. government does not believe that an external support network exists.
And specifically, who do you believe that external support network consists of?
Primarily Saudis. As you stated, 15 of the 19 hijackers were themselves Saudi nationals with government involvement, were the primary funders of Al-Qaeda, and continue to be a primary funder, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said during her tenure, that the primary source of funding of terrorism was Saudi Arabia. And I also, Saudi Arabia has been the principal promoter of this extreme form of Islam called Wahhabism, where young people are taught intolerance, jihad, and encouraged to act out against non-believers, and therefore have provided a steady stream of fresh recruits to terrorist organizations, from Al-Qaeda to now ISIS.
Senator, why do you think that the United States government ignored the warnings that something terrible was going to happen prior to 9/11? And then my next question is going to be, why haven't they been more forthright in discussing who might have done it afterwards? But let's talk about before 9/11. Isn't it true that the president gets a daily briefing, and mightn't he have been warned about this?
Yes, and he was. The 9/11 Commission developed the concept. It was a lack of imagination that we knew significant amount about Al-Qaeda and about what its intentions were. They had tried to hijack airplanes in the Philippines several years before 9/11. They had been the primary operatives in the attacks on two U.S. embassies in Africa, so they were not an unknown adversary. With all of that, we didn't have the imagination that they might be plotting to attack not thousands of miles away on another continent, but attack in the United States and use as the means of that attack the same technology, commercial airliners, that they had tried to use in the Philippines.
After the attack, there's 28 pages of the report that haven't been released. And I know that you're under constraints and can't talk about what's in those pages, but I know you've written a book called Keys to the Kingdom, which is a novel about that. And I wondered whether you might talk about the novel so we could try to understand what's been suppressed.
First, about the 28 pages. The final report that was submitted in December of 2002 was over 800 pages. One chapter of 28 pages was totally redacted, and that chapter has been publicly acknowledged as primarily dealing with who financed 9/11 and pointed a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia, not surprisingly. I wrote a book called Intelligence Matters, which is a nonfiction book about the before 9/11, during, and then the investigation afterwards. There was a significant amount of that book which was censured. I was frustrated by that, and while I was a senior fellow at the Kennedy School, one of the faculty members suggested that I could tell the stories that were excluded from the nonfiction Intelligence Matters by writing it as a novel. So that was the origin of Keys to the Kingdom. I say Intelligence Matters asks the questions, and Keys to the Kingdom gives the answers.
Senator, tell us a bit about the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandor. Why did he get President Bush to allow over 100 persons to fly out of the U.S. right after 9/11 before they could be questioned?
He had a very personal relationship with the Bush administration and with President Bush himself. The Bush family has been close to the House of Saud going back to the grandfather, Prescott Bush. So when the ambassador called the White House in the hours immediately after 9/11 saying that he wanted to meet with the president, he was accommodated. They met in the White House. Prince Bandor said that there were many elite Saudis in the United States. It happened that at that time in Kentucky, the horse sales were going on, and that had brought together not only Saudis who lived in the United States, but Saudis from around the world, and that he, Prince Bandor, was concerned that they were going to be harassed and asked the president for permission, even though most of American aviation was grounded at the time, if he could get a chartered plane to fly these Saudi elites back to their home in Saudi Arabia. The president agreed with that, and a few days later, after collecting Saudis elsewhere, chartered plane flew from Lexington, Kentucky to Saudi Arabia with approximately 145 elite Saudis, including members of Osama bin Laden's family, back to Riyadh.
Whoa. Let's talk about Osama bin Laden, if we might, Senator. Bin Laden was, of course, from one of the elite families in Saudi Arabia. And there's been speculation that he told the government that he was willing to cause civil unrest in that country, that he was unhappy about certain policies that the government was carrying out, particularly with respect to the United States. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, the background of that goes to the first Persian Gulf War, the one that was in 1990-91 when Iraq had invaded Kuwait. Bin Laden had just come off being a major factor in defeating the Russians in Afghanistan and had some 30,000 war-hardened veterans at his call. He went to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and said, I can protect the kingdom from Saddam Hussein. You don't need to call on the Europeans or the Americans. The king at that time rejected bin Laden's offer and, in fact, did invite the United States and the Europeans, who in the early period of 1991 routed the Iraqis from Kuwait. Bin Laden never forgot that slight. At some point later in the 1990s, when he had returned to Afghanistan and was beginning the planning for what became 9/11, he became aware that this was going to be a very complicated process. Compare what happened in 9/11 to what happened in Paris recently. The complexity of hijacking multiple airlines at the same time, having people who were technically capable then of flying the airplanes, being able to identify the targets and hit them in a very compressed period of time, were daunting challenges. Bin Laden figured out that these 19 people, with their linguistic and cultural limitations, were unlikely to be able to do that, and so he went to the kingdom and said, we want your support. I'm not saying that he specifically told the Saudi royal family what his ultimate plan was, but that he was going to have representatives of Al-Qaeda in the United States, and they needed to have people who could assist them, provide financing, give them access to some of the services that they would need, such as flight training, and protect their anonymity, and that if the kingdom didn't do all of the above, he would unleash his 30,000 warriors and start a civil war in Saudi Arabia. The kingdom capitulated and made available to the bin Laden a network primarily based on people who had been representing Saudi Arabia surreptitiously in the United States to oversee young Saudis, college age principally, who the kingdom were concerned might be plotting against the kingdom in the same way that college students had overthrown the Shah of Iran. A complicated story, but bin Laden played the piano of all of these different people, histories, values, concerns very well, and the kingdom made available to him what he'd requested, and I don't think 9/11 would have happened but for that.
Is that the reason you think that this has all been covered up?
Why it's been covered up by the United States government is another mystery. It's easier to answer the question for the Bush administration. I mentioned earlier the close personal relationship that the Bush family had with the House of Saud. Oil was another consideration. When President Obama ran in 2008, he ran on a platform of opposition to the war in Iraq. There was a lot of expectation that he would reverse these policies of non-disclosure of information about 9/11 when he became president. And in fact, and I can't say this firsthand, but it's been reported that President Obama told some of the families of the victims of 9/11 that he would release these documents. And now, in his 8th year as president, it hasn't happened. I'm an optimist. I still hold out hope that before January 20th, 2017, that President Obama will deliver on that promise that he has allegedly made and make all this information available to let the American people know what's the nature of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and be part of the decision-making process as to what should we do about it.
Senator, what are you doing now to secure the release of the suppressed 28 pages?
Well, there are a number of things which I hope are going to contribute to President Obama deciding to release these. One of those is this considerable amount of media interest, which had been dormant up until about a year ago. Now there are regular stories and reports much in line with what we're talking about today. Also in the Congress, there is a resolution to ask the president to release specifically the 28 pages on who financed 9/11. I think there's growing pressure for a release, and I hope it'll reach critical mass in the next 12 months.
The government of Saudi Arabia has been sued on behalf of wrongful death suits on behalf of the family of people who were murdered in the towers. They put up a defense of sovereign immunity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. First, it's very interesting that they have used the defense of sovereign immunity not just to protect the kingdom, but to protect a whole series of charities, foundations, religious institutions, all of which have been alleged to have been involved in some phase of supporting the 9/11 hijackers, primarily financing. Then the Saudi government says, although we use sovereign immunity to protect all these groups from litigation in a U.S. court, we, the kingdom, were not involved in any of these things, and therefore you can't sue us, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't say sovereign immunity applies to non-governmental groups and then say, but the government itself, which is using that defense, is immune. The status is that under the current law that governs suits against terrorist groups by U.S. citizens in U.S. courts, it's almost necessary to make your case beyond reasonable doubt before you can even get a hearing. And what has happened is that on several occasions, the families of 9/11 victims have been dismissed from court. And I'm sad to report the U.S. government has supported those dismissals. Now the Second District in New York City has reversed at least one of those dismissals, and the case has been refiled, and it's working its way back through the system. And in Congress, there's an effort underway to change the law so that it's not so onerous, and plaintiffs representing persons who have been killed or otherwise adversely affected by terrorists can get their day in court. I hope that this Congress will pass that. It almost passed at the last Congress, and I am optimistic again that that the Congress that's seated today will make adjustments to the law so that it will be more rational for American citizens to find justice.
Senator Bob Graham, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts on this before we have to say goodbye.
Yes, maybe the most persuasive argument to Americans to keep all these materials disclosed is national security, that in some way it would have an adverse effect on our safety if this information were made public. I think it is absolutely the opposite, that the fact is that we have sent a message to Saudi Arabia that they can do anything with impunity, with absolute assurance that they will not be sanctioned. And that fact of the message of impunity through the unwillingness to disclose information in the possession of the United States government about Saudi Arabia's action at 9/11 has encouraged Saudi Arabia to continue to support terrorist groups, now ISIS, and to continue madrasas and mosques, which shape the young minds of Muslims, so that they are prepared and religiously motivated to want to fill the ranks of ISIS or other terrorist organizations. So to me, our national security is being dramatically adversely affected by the way in which we have related to Saudi Arabia for its support for the 9/11 hijackers. I think it's an outrage, and I hope that the Obama administration will not leave this as their legacy.
Senator Bob Graham, it's really been an honor for us to have a person with your intelligence and courage on Law and Disorder, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your carrying this message to the people of America.
Thank you, Senator.
Best of luck.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.